Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben, and today my guest is David Woodbridge. David is the author of the recently published book, Missionary Primitivism and Chinese Modernity, The Brethren in 20th Century China, just out from Brill. David, congratulations on the book and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and the background to the project?
The immediate background to the project was me going to the University of Manchester for postgraduate studies. I did my master's and my PhD there, and that's where I first got into Chinese history and decided I wanted to explore a bit more the history of the British involvement in China, and in particular to look at missionaries. And I decided to begin by looking at the archive material I could find immediately around me. And the University of Manchester has an archive to do with the history of the Brethren movement and had recently acquired some of its missionary material. So I explored that initially for an MA dissertation and then began to look at it in a bit more depth for a PhD. And although I hadn't intended the whole project to be about the Brethren, I found that the material was so interesting, so rich that there was certainly enough there to develop a larger project.
So many of our listeners will know that the John Rylands University Library in Manchester is one of the great academic libraries in the UK, isn't it? It's got enormous holdings in terms of documents from the New Testament, you know, all the way through to the present day. And it has a very rich seam of what we might call Protestant dissenting archives as well. There's a Methodist archive. And you've mentioned the archive called the Christian Brethren Archive. Just in case listeners aren't familiar with this group, could you briefly tell us who are the Plymouth Brethren or the Christian Brethren and why do they matter?
Yeah, so the archive itself actually was started by a member of the Plymouth Brethren. That was F.F. Bruce, who was professor of, I'm going to get his title wrong, theology or biblical studies or something of that ilk at the University of Manchester. So he began it. But the Brethren themselves were a nonconformist group, had its origins in the early 19th century in Britain and Ireland. And it's hard to pin down their origins, I guess. They were initially started out as groups of evangelicals who wanted to try and push for greater Christian unity, you know, between denominations, and gradually developed into a movement in and of itself that sought to return to faith the practices of the early church. And to do that, they sought to turn their back on, I guess, historical tradition and denominational tradition, and just to try and live by the tenets and the example of the New Testament.
Now, in your book, David, you give this the term primitivism, which is the ideal of living or organizing church as closely as possible to the examples provided in the New Testament. And in your book, primitivism obviously is there in the book's title, Missionary Primitivism and Chinese Modernity. But in the book, you give us a couple of examples of what primitivism means for brethren missionaries in China and elsewhere, I suppose, too. One of those big themes is hesitation about engagement in politics. And I suppose the second of those big themes is the desire to live by faith. Could you talk us through what each of those themes means or represents, or how they were worked out in practice?
Yes, I think in terms of politics, you know, when the Brethren were emerging kind of in the early mid 19th century, missionary activity was largely carried out by large established missionary societies. And I guess the expansion of these missionary societies was very much closely entwined with the expansion of the British Empire. They tended to follow where colonialists went or where areas had been opened up to trade. And the Brethren felt that the model of the missionary society was very much a secular one. It seemed very kind of business-like. They would have a board of trustees, and they would try and get people to subscribe and donate, and they would recruit and employ missionaries and send them out. And the Brethren felt that this had more in common with the modern secular business model than it did with the original vision of the early church. So they sought to kind of reorganize missionary work to try and return to the idea of church sending out missionaries, and for the church and for individual missionaries to be responding to the call of the Holy Spirit rather than being organized by human institutions, I suppose.
So there is a kind of an anti-institutional theme running through a lot of your book, isn't it? That's what primitivism seems to mean for many of these Brethren missionaries. But I suppose one of the great advantages of being a missionary with a mission organization was that you had a fair chance of getting your salary on time. How did Brethren missionaries finance their endeavor?
I mean, that brings us to the second of the two points you mentioned, which is living by faith. So rather than missionaries relying on a salary paid by a missionary society, the Brethren felt that missionaries should be relying on God to provide for them. And that was an idea that I guess you can probably trace it back to a figure called George Muller, who was one of the early kind of Brethren figureheads, who opened a number of orphanages in southwest England and sought to use them as a demonstration to people that God would provide for those who set out to do stuff according to his will, according to his purposes. So living by faith, missionaries weren't saying that God would send support falling from the sky like manna from heaven, although, you know, they testified that if need be, in situations where there was need, he could do that and he would do that. It was more that rather than missionary support being initiated and organized by a human organization, a committee, it should be individual Christians, individual churches responding to God's calling, God's prompting for them to give and to support missionaries. It was very much, you know, it's still essentially, it was churches, it was individual people supporting missionaries, but it wasn't done in an organized way. The idea was that you responded to the leading, the prompting of the Spirit to give support to individual missionaries.
So in some ways, this anti-institutional impulse within Brethren missionary culture could be seen as anti-modernist, couldn't it? It's opposed to organisation. It's deeply individualistic, you might say. It's certainly quite in tune with the romantic tenor of the 19th century and perhaps even into the early 20th century. But you describe the impact of and development of this primitivist culture within a very specific context, which you describe as Chinese modernity. So how does Brethren anti-modernity impact upon or be impacted by Chinese modernity? What's happening? Just remind us briefly, what's happening in China in the first half of the 20th century, and what ways does that represent an alternative modernity to that of the Brethren?
Yeah, so this is a very tumultuous time in China. The final imperial dynasty, which was the Qing dynasty, had come to an end in 1911. It had really struggled through the 19th century. There had been internal rebellions and increasingly pressure from the West, from the outside, but it had kind of staggered on, kept going, but finally collapsed in 1911. there was an effort after that to form a Chinese Republic, but that was not a great success. The country really fragmented into a lot of different regions, many of them controlled and run by local warlords. So during the first half of the 20th century, China was very divided, and there were different political groups in conflict. In particular, you had the Nationalist Party, who were effectively the government for most of the time, but you also had the Communist Party, which was emerging and becoming stronger and stronger. So you had a very chaotic internal situation, but also there was a growing threat from outside as well, particularly from Japan, which had rapidly modernized during the 19th century, had become a very powerful country and was looking to expand its influence into East Asia. So yes, this is the kind of political context of what's going on. And yeah, like you say, it's really the beginnings of modern China, I guess, as we know it, as we see it today. You had the collapse of a centuries-old, a millennia-old even, kind of imperial system with an emperor and a ruling dynasty, and an effort to create something else, a state along modern lines with, you know, a modern government, modern statecraft and institutions. So yes, the Brethren were operating within a China that was seeking to break away from the past and establish some kind of new form which could take them on and flourish in the modern world.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So in some ways that might seem to be quite an unpromising context for a Western missionary group that are deeply anti-politics and very apathetic, if not hostile, actively hostile towards organization or institutions. How did the Brethren get on? Were they influential in China? How many Christians are there in China now, and have the Brethren influenced them in any distinctive ways?
Yeah, so listeners are probably fairly aware of the situation in China regards Christianity. There has been a huge growth in the number of Christians in China, particularly of Protestants, and that gets kind of sporadic news coverage in the West, particularly when there's instances of conflict with the government. So numbers are difficult to come, well, reliable numbers are difficult to come by, I guess, mostly because you have a government-approved church in China, but you also have many Christians who choose not to be part of government-approved meetings, and they are much more difficult to count. So, I mean, estimates in terms of numbers range from about 20 million, which is more around the official government estimate, to some would estimate 100 million plus. So there's clearly a huge range of opinion there. So probably safer to put it somewhere in the middle, around 50 or 60 million, I suppose. But even then, it's very hard to tell. But I would argue, the book argues, that the Brethren have been very influential in making this happen. I don't think, as a distinct missionary presence, they weren't particularly big, and I'm sure you can find churches today in China, I know you can do, that will trace their origins to churches set up by Brethren missionaries. But the main influence the Brethren have had on the present day Chinese Protestant Church is through the influence they had on Watchman Nee, who set up one of the first independent Chinese churches, which has proven to be very successful, both in terms of the numbers of people who claim to be part of this movement, but also the broader influence through his life and through his writings that he's had on Chinese Protestantism.
Now, you give us in the book a chapter on Watchman Nee, and in some ways this is the heart of the book, isn't it? It's the moment when what might be quite abstract or quite Western Brethren theological ideas or church practices become voiced in a Chinese context, which you argue in the book in a very interesting way, is a Chinese context which is a port city context, a middle class context, and a context in which, I think you tell us, Watchman Nee is a third generation Protestant, a context in which Christianity is already a very familiar world.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, Watchman Nee doesn't appear out of nowhere. He emerges from a context where Christianity or Protestantism has become relatively well established. So when the West was first able to get access to China in the mid-19th century, it initially was limited to operating in five major coastal ports. And ostensibly that was for trade, but also missionaries were able to follow in behind and begin operating. So in one of these ports, which is Fuzhou, where Watchman Nee grew up, he was essentially a third generation of a family who had been converted to Christianity in the mid to late 19th century. So there was already a fairly well-established Protestant community in Fuzhou, and Watchman Nee, although he had his own individual spiritual journey, his own conversion story, he was very much operating within a well-established Chinese Protestant community, and one that was thinking about how it could stand on its own, how it could break away from its association with the West and really try and build its own identity as a local Chinese church.
And in your book, David, you show us how, perhaps it's an irony, how it's Brethren ideas that actually make that possible, the idea of being self-supporting, being autonomous, providing its own leadership, etc.
Yeah, that's right. So the Brethren, as I mentioned before, you know, it began in Britain as an attempt to break away from Christian historical traditions and denominational traditions, and to establish something that was based more on the earliest practices of Christian faith as outlined in the New Testament. And you then see, very kind of interestingly, this process kind of being repeated in China in the case of Watchman Nee. He looks around him and sees a quite well-established Protestant churches and denominations, and he's looking for something more pure, I guess, something better than what he sees around him. And yes, he finds the ideas of the Brethren very, very compelling. This idea that you can turn your back on human tradition and just return to a model of faith and practice that you don't need established leaders, you don't need to follow tradition, you just need to follow the simple guidelines in the New Testament. So yes, it's interesting how you see the process that the Brethren went through themselves in the 19th century kind of repeated among Chinese Christians in the kind of early mid-20th century.
And I suppose too, in that chapter, David, one of the paradoxes is that Nee's drive towards primitivism is enabled by the tools of modernity. You talk about his access to publishing, printing facilities, the family business that he takes employment in for a while. And you show in that chapter how the tentacles of that family business, as they stretch gradually out from and eventually across China, provide the mechanisms for travel, for currency exchange. I mean, there's a huge number of aspects in that chapter, isn't there, of the ways in which modernity is enabling this primitivist missionary impulse. Could we talk also about two brethren missionaries that you also devote a chapter to, Geoffrey Bull and George Patterson? Tell us about these guys.
Yeah, so Geoffrey Bull, George Patterson, both fascinating figures. Geoffrey Bull in particular, I found, was someone who many people were familiar with. If I mentioned, particularly in church circles, the name Geoffrey Bull when I was carrying out my research, quite a few people were familiar with his name or had read his books. And, you know, not just brethren, he had people familiar with him from wider circles as well. So Geoffrey Bull was famous for a book he wrote called When Iron Gates Yield, which was an account of his time in prison under the Chinese communists. He was arrested while he was a missionary after the communists came to power, spent 3 years in prison before being released. And he was one of the last missionaries to leave China. So by the time he was released, there had been a lot of publicity, a lot of media attention to his plight. And so when he published his book, his account of his experiences, it sold very well. It made him a bit of a celebrity. And so he had gone on, become a missionary, had gone to Tibet, and he had gone with another brethren missionary called George Patterson, who's a fascinating figure. In fact, I decided to explore this story because when I began my research, I got in touch with Neil Dixon, who part of a Brethren Historians network, and he told me about George, who was still alive at that time, and offered to take me to meet him. And I was fortunate enough to be able to interview him a couple of times. And yeah, his story is a fascinating one. So Geoffrey Bull, George Patterson were only missionaries for a short time. They went out to China after World War II and both wanted to try and preach the gospel in Tibet. They made it to Tibet and they made it further into the interior of Tibet than most missionaries had been able to. But just as it seemed like they were going to get established there, you had the communist revolution, and once they got into power, the communists wanted to establish the borders of their new state, and that involved taking over Tibet. And once they'd done that, then they didn't want any Westerners in there and interfering. So George Patterson had left previously, but Geoffrey Bull was there when the communists arrived, and that was when he was imprisoned.
They're both extraordinary characters, Geoffrey Bull and George Patterson, aren't they? One of the really complicating factors that they have to think through on the field in the interior of Tibet, high up on the plateau, is how they relate to a culture that's so utterly alien, but also a culture that's so heavily politicized. And you show in the book really wonderfully how they have to begin to consider or reconsider this anti-political impulse that has driven brethren missions up to this point. And you show how they align themselves with a particular family, a very significant family, with lots of financial and political interests, which they can begin to make use of to develop their work. How does this political context challenge their apolitical sensibilities as they had developed up to that point?
One of the questions I was really interested in when taking on this project was to consider the relationship of missionary activity to the development of modernity in China. And yeah, the brethren were fascinating in this respect, just because they perhaps possibly more than other Protestant groups were insistent on trying to keep that division between their spiritual vocation and the modern world they found themselves in. And you know, part of that was to avoid being involved in modern political movements. But like you say, Geoffrey Bull, George Patterson found this increasingly difficult in the context of Tibet. So they really found themselves in a situation where they had to make a choice, really. Tibet at that time, its political status was uncertain. It had kind of been operating as nominally part of the Chinese Empire, but effectively being led and governing itself autonomously. And there was a lot of discussion within Tibet itself about what the future would hold now that the dynasty had collapsed and new possibilities, new opportunities were open. So Bull and Patterson found themselves in alliance with perhaps an unusual, unexpected group in Tibet, a growing middle class seeking greater political representation. So Bull and Patterson really found themselves in a situation where they had to choose. They wanted to continue being missionaries in China, in Tibet. They needed the support of its political elite, and they really threw their lot in with Pandasang family, who were seeking to set up some kind of modern constitutional arrangement in Tibet. And siding with them really meant that they pitted themselves against the incoming communist government.
Both men, as you describe in the book, go on to very successful careers after that. Bull, although he becomes a literary celebrity with When Iron Gates Yield and a couple of follow-on books, becomes a fairly conventional Brethren preacher. Patterson, on the other hand, publishes a string of books about his adventures with Faber and Faber, very impressive London literary publisher. Enters journalism, enters politics, loses his faith, sets up rehabilitation scheme with his wife, Meg Patterson, spends the 1960s working with rock stars like Eric Clapton, through whom he rediscovers his faith. That's interesting, comes out in the most recent Eric Clapton biography as well. Goes on tour with The Who. I mean, it's an extraordinary story, the story of George Patterson, isn't it?
Yeah.
David, you've written a phenomenal book, Missionary Primitivism and Chinese Modernity, The Brethren in 20th Century China, that speaks to so many big themes, both in terms of religious modernity, but also Chinese history during this tumultuous period. Just recently published by Brill, 2019. It's an exceptional piece of writing, and thanks very much for coming onto the show to talk about it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, thanks for your time, and take care. And thanks to everyone else for listening in today. I'll see you next time on New Books and Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.